The way we're going about decarbonization is probably right now the worst way you could go about it.
Wind, solar, and storage kind of make energy efficiency a tougher sell from an economic standpoint.
There is a reality in which we have to kind of just build out new infrastructure that will be costly.
I don't think it's necessarily the case that you have to go wind, solar, batteries. I think that nuclear is a better option than that even.
The best possible path from where we are today, which is prices are too damn high, to where we want to get, which is reliable power system.
When a company puts something in the rate base and it gets approved in the rate case, your prices never really go down.
Hey everyone, and welcome to Power Perspectives. I'm Kinsey Grant Baker. Today we're tackling one of the big three. So we always talk about the do or die importance of reliability, resilience, and affordability of our power systems. In the conversation we've got teed up here today, we are zeroing in on that last one. Affordability, how it became so elusive, and what policymakers are doing about it. The question we want to answer here, which policies are actually driving higher costs and which are being used as political cover? Because when nearly a quarter of adults, over 52 million people, cannot pay their power bills in the wealthiest country in the world, something's got to give. Today, let's find out what. Our two guests are esteemed power pros who have built a major following on Substack with their newsletter Energy Bad Boys, plus their work at Always On Energy Research. Always On is a 501c3 dedicated to ensuring that every state in America has the affordable, reliable energy needed to power the nation and to fuel a robust, rapidly growing economy now and into the future. Isaac Orr is founder and VP of research at Always On. Mitch Rowling is founder and director of research at Always On. Mitch, Isaac, welcome to Power Perspectives. How are you today?
Great. You can catch your breath now. That was a lot to say, wasn't it? Yeah, well, thanks for having us on, Kinsey. We really appreciate it. And looking forward to a fun conversation today.
Yeah, same.
Absolutely. Me too. I mean, this is a topic people love. I love talking with people who are creating content and doing research in the space. You guys certainly have the chops to really bring a lot to this conversation. So I think we can dig right into it. I want to start here before we get into some of the kind of meat of the conversation about this affordability crisis by just getting the quick intro to the two of you. You know, I teed up Always On and the work that you're doing on Substack, but I would love to just hear a little bit more about, you know, who you are, what you do. Maybe what brought you to the world of energy in the first place?
All right. Well, I'll go first because I think I know Mitch's answer kind of plays off of mine. So I grew up on a dairy farm in Wisconsin. So like I kind of have this predisposition to, most people think milk comes from the store and that's not where it comes from. And they also tend to think electricity comes from the outlet and that's not where it comes from. So I've kind of always felt that people didn't understand the nexus between where something is created and where it is consumed. And one of the things that happened, I was in my environmental geology class in college. I went to University of Wisconsin, Eau Claire, and my professor was talking about like well pressure and all of this other stuff. Like, okay, well, if you drill a well, are you going to have enough water? And one of the things that always happened to us in the summertime is like, it'd get really hot and the cows would get thirsty and they drink so much water that we didn't have any water in the house. So when I'm in this class and we're talking about water pressure, I'm like, this is very interesting. So then I went for poli-sci and geology, and that kind of got me into like the energy space. And here I am today.
Yeah. And mine definitely does play off Isaac because he's the reason. You're looking at the reason I'm in this world today. I was a history major.
I birthed him.
Yeah.
It was many hours of sustained labor.
I'm sure, that was really difficult.
Yeah, it was. It was. It was painful.
Yeah, I didn't take right away. I went to school originally for history, you know, so a lot of my background is trying to discern historical truths and see what the facts of the matter and, you know, creating sound narratives from historical facts. And, you know, when I met Isaac, I was an intern at where we worked originally at the Center of the American Experiment. And I just kind of got paired with him and we started doing things together and trying to take down, you know, the policies we didn't like that we saw Minnesota was doing and, you know, trying to combat XL Energy, who was kind of our, you know, main enemy at the time, I would say.
Enemy is a strong word, Mitch, but why don't you tell the folks like what I made you do? Like this, I think is a great show for you to kind of elaborate. Like, I was sitting there, and one of the things that gets, you know, levelized cost of energy gets abused as a metric all the time. And one of its main shortcomings is that it does not compare apples to apples in terms of, like, you have this existing power plant today that's largely depreciated. It's low cost for ratepayers. It's reliable. And you're comparing it to the cost of, like, new wind or solar. Very common, I don't know, tactic argument that I think is not giving the public the full context. So I wanted to know, well, what's the cost of, you know, the Sherburne County generating station in Minnesota? Like, there's a way to figure that out, is to look through the FERC forms. I made Mitch do it as an intern. And then, like, he figured it out, because you had to go through a whole bunch of hoops, because what was it? The FERC didn't even have, like, software that was supported anymore by the original. Like, it was, this is the nerdiest podcast we're going to be on. So, like, this is the point where you can talk about that.
Well, sure. Yeah. There were several things he had me do. Cause I mean, when I met Isaac, I wasn't in energy at all. Like, I would travel to Texas and there'd be wind farms on the side, and me and my girlfriend, now wife, but girlfriend at the time, would stop and take pictures out of, like, I just was not, you know, they were a cool picture moment, you know, and I didn't think anything about it. But when I met Isaac, he kind of led me through this training course where I almost went back to school. I started doing free college courses online, and kind of discovered the ins and outs of the energy markets there. And then, you know, he had me write kind of reports that didn't get really published, but we used them for articles later. But, you know, like, kind of taking someone's argument and trying to make counterpoints and seeing where they're accurate or not. But then when you get to the FERC stuff, this is really where I think our work together really began, where we kind of both had our strengths and then kind of used them to, you know, make an impact in this energy space. One of the things we wanted to look at was, what's the cost of the existing resources on the grid? One of the only sources you can find that is through the FERC Form 1 data. And this is where utilities file cost metrics and stuff. So you can get the capital cost, the O&M expenses, fuel expenses, and you can see what are our existing resources costing. Because at the time, the discussion was, well, what should we be building, you know, new wind or new gas or new coal? But we were also retiring a bunch of power plants. And so we wanted to know, well, should we be keeping these open? Should we even be building new things? You know, at the time, energy, you know, the energy demand really wasn't growing at the time. So it really was a conversation of, should we be keeping these existing resources open or not? And when I got to FERC, they had this, I forget what it was, but they had this process to get into the data.
It's like crazy file viewer or something.
Yeah.
Like,
yeah,
it was like the most archaic thing and so emblematic of the way that, like, government databases work.
Right.
So,
well, and it wasn't even in, it wasn't around anymore. It was actually,
yeah, it was extinct. Like, you had to look through it. Yeah.
And so I had to figure out a different viewer to get all the data. And then it came in very wonky, you know, data files. And so I spent a lot of time downloading all these files and then, you know, back to 1994. And that's where we discovered that
the year you were born, right?
Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
Yeah.
So,
yeah,
we covered my entire lifetime.
So.
And yeah, that was how we discovered that. And then one thing led to another. We started developing models, and, you know, we can get into that too. But yeah, that was kind of my introduction to everything.
I love it. I mean, you're right, Isaac, that this is hopefully the nerdiest show that you guys have taken the energy bad boys to over the years. But, you know, this does help really set the scene, because so much of what we're going to talk about today is trying to discern what is narrative versus what is hard fact, what is data. I think that is really a big driving force of the conversation around affordability. So I personally appreciate getting a little bit more of the background of how you two came to work together, because I am, you know, a fan of the Substack, have read it for a while, really like the work that you guys are doing. I think, you know, all of this data-driven approach to understanding a lot of these big topics is the preferred method of understanding them for a lot of the people who are going to be listening to this episode. So very important context. So let's get into this affordability stuff. You know, I want to start this conversation by, you know, really making sure that we can dig deep into what the problem is itself. You know, if we want to fix it, I think we got to understand it first. So when we talk about this quote unquote energy affordability crisis, I would love to hear your perspectives on what that means in practical terms for households, for businesses. You know, what is the state of the typical customer's energy burden and maybe how that's evolved in recent years, according to your findings, your data?
Well, I mean, I think people are just like sick of paying too much for everything. And that's not necessarily just an electricity specific thing. I think groceries have a lot to do with that. Like the cost of beef is way too high right now. Like, you know, we've been cutting back personally. So like, I think it's just kind of like these staple, like basket of goods, if you will, just like costs way too much. And that's making people upset about their electric bills as well. I think that's a big part of it. And you know, if they've gone up a lot. You look at the trends nationally since 2019, the prices have gone up quite a bit. And, you know, the other aspect of this is, you know, Mitch and I talk about this pretty frequently. As your system becomes more fixed cost dependent, so let's say you're going to be retiring your fuel-based resources and moving more towards fixed costs. Like, sure, you have fuel savings, but if you reduce your electricity consumption, you're just spreading your fixed costs over fewer megawatt hours. So your rates are actually going up. So like at some point, once you adopt a system, you know, let's just say wind and solar generally, right? You could say that too with nuclear, because the cost per megawatt hour are more dominated by capital or fixed cost than the fuel cost. But, you know, wind, solar and storage kind of make energy efficiency a tougher sell from an economic standpoint, because you're just going to be, you know, amortizing those costs over fewer megawatt hours. Utilities get to increase their cost either through a true up or a decoupling mechanism. You know, the whole like put a sweater on and lower your electric bill works in some places where you have more of a fuel based system a little bit. But like, how much do you want people to put their sweaters on too, right? Like this entire idea of like demand response, like your grocery bill is too high. Have you considered skipping lunch? Like, is that really what we want to be promoting as a society when it comes to the power system? And that's, you know, not how we feel. We want, you know, an abundance of low cost power that's reliable. And then if you can make it cleaner over time, cool. But let's, you know, have an honest conversation about those trade-offs. So, you know, from a regional perspective, we tend to see that the bluer the area, the higher the rate. When it comes to the prices, some of that is due to places like California having lower per capita assumption or consumption. So you're spreading those, you know, like we said, you know, it's the rate is all about the, you know, the cost divided by, you know, the denominator of the megawatt hours. But, you know, they also have a bunch of policies there that contribute to that. So you have, you know, 100% carbon free mandates, you have cap and trade systems. Or, you know, greenhouse gas trading, taxes, that sort of thing. You have, you know, more opposition to pipelines. These areas were more likely to have banned nuclear power plants and shut down their existing depreciated nuclear plants, as well as their coal plants. So always on is our day job, people. So if you'd like to donate to that, you can definitely do that. But it was with the Institute for Energy Research. We called it Blue States, High Rates. And we have this map that just shows if your state is red, it's below the national average. And if your state is blue, it's above the national average. And it's basically an electoral map, except for Washington, Oregon, New Mexico, Minnesota, and Colorado, and Virginia. Like those are the blue states with rates below the national average. And you know, it's pretty much easier to explain why those states are below the national average than it is to kind of discredit this idea that, okay, well, policy matters, especially at a state level. Federal Power Act says, you know, states have wide, you know, powers to figure out what their resource mix is going to be. And you look at it, Oregon and Washington had a very Green New Deal in the 1930s where they built large hydro facilities that, you know, still provide a lot of very cheap energy today. New Mexico has had some of the most insane load growth out of any state in the country, and it's almost entirely due to the Permian Basin. So they have a delivered cost of natural gas at their power plants of 99 cents a million BTU, which is just like a third of the cost of most other places in the country because they have more gas than they can use. And then they've also had load growth of like a third since like 2010 or something ridiculous. So, you know, you divide the numerator by a much larger denominator and you get lower rates. And then, you know, Minnesota and Colorado had prices that were about 20% below the national average. in 2007. And we've seen that, you know, competitive advantage erode over time. You know, prices have gotten more expensive. If you're an early adopter on a new technology, you tend to pay higher prices. And that's just why I waited until like iPhone 5 to come out before I got a smartphone. But so like those states, 2007, that was on the earlier end. You were looking at very expensive PPAs for wind. Solar was still in this like way too expensive to even think about even incorporating into your renewable portfolio standard. Like later on, like a few years later, they started to incorporate carve outs for solar, but that was after the price had come down a little bit. So that's a really long-winded way of kind of talking about it. But, you know, essentially people are upset everything costs too much. And, you know, these price increases are impacting red and blue states. It's just the actual rates are increasing faster in bluer areas than red ones.
I think what I'd add to that is, you know, Isaac started that by saying, you know, beef is too expensive, so we've been cutting back. Well, you can't really do the same with electricity, right? You need it for your daily life. And I think that's why in energy, that's why it's so, it's a pain point for so many people. And also what Isaac said, and even if you do cut back, we're getting to a point where a lot of these costs are now being baked into fixed costs. And so if you try to cut back, well, in a year or two, they're just going to have a rate case and recuperate all of those expenses again. So we're getting to this point where this is a significant strain for families, but also businesses who, you know, if you're lucky enough, you can try to move to a different state and try to go to a lower cost area. But we're seeing many places just shut down because the cost is too expensive. So that's what I would add to that. It's just it's more difficult to try to cut down your electricity use. You need it for daily life.
Yeah. Yeah. And it also, you know, the entire premise of cutting back assumes certain things about what have proven time and time again in energy and elsewhere to be irrationally behaved people, right? We don't always behave in our best interest. I think we talk a lot on this show about you know, your bill really being the number one way that a utility can communicate with the typical neighbor down the street who is complaining about utility prices. But at the end of the day, there are so many more inputs and, you know, it's not always easy to communicate all of those to average everyday people who might have these complaints about the prices and the affordability itself. You know, a lot of this, I think, sets us up for a much bigger conversation about this red versus blue when we're having the affordability conversation. But before we get into that a little bit deeper and some of the, you know, sort of subcategories of that assertion, I want to understand where we're seeing these increases in prices show up most clearly in the utility system. You know, we're talking a lot about the generation mix, original kind of more upstream sources here. Is there anywhere else that we should be talking about the conversation for affordability, you know, transmission capacity? Where else is this kind of cropping up as a major topic that deserves more attention?
I mean, it's all of it, right, Kinsey? Like the Lawrence Berkeley Brattle study came out and they said a lot of this is transmission and distribution spending. Like that's a big reason for it. There's been a ton of inflation in the cost of all of these components as well. So, you know, if you're trying to get a transformer, get a substation built, hire an EPC company, like, you know, a lot of these guys, I don't know, some of these interviews say like any electrician who will travel is already in Texas. So we have like labor shortages, we have impacts from like higher raw material prices, but also this is a pet theory of mine. I haven't really had anybody outside the industry or inside the industry validate this, but I guess this is as good a chance as any to throw it out there. And then if I'm wrong, someone will correct me. That's the great thing. Like if you say something confidently and you're wrong, then somebody will correct you. But if you ask someone for help, they'll be like, yeah, whatever, I don't need to answer this. So I'm going to say it very strongly. And then someone will come out and say it's not right. But we've all agreed that this is the reason why I'm doing it. My theory is that a lot of data centers are buying up this equipment at any cost, right? So perhaps they are creating scarcity. There's supply, there's demand. And if you're doing a lot of the, you know, local distribution level stuff, transmission level stuff, and you have a, you know, customer that is not price sensitive, then perhaps they are bidding up the clearing cost of the components that everybody else needs in order for distribution and transmission. So like I said, I haven't had anybody say, yes, I think that's right. It's just kind of been a theory, but if we look at the fact that, you know, new natural gas plants now cost combined cycle $2,200 a kilowatt, $25, I've heard $3,000 a kilowatt. But I haven't seen the spec sheet that says that, but we have this like really inflated range. Cause like 5 years ago we were looking at like 1,000. So like, I think it stands to reason that this like large increase, like that could be another way where data centers are potentially impacting the cost. But, you know, we look at the S&P Global analysis of utilities. They look at 39 utilities within the US and then 5 in Canada. And 19% of the overall CapEx that they're projecting moving forward over the next 5 years, that's wind, solar, and batteries. And that is now a larger component than like thermal generation in this like stack of, you know, different costs. So yes, transmission is up slightly, and distribution's up relative as a share of the relative spending. So unfortunately, the graph that we have from S&P Global shows everything as a share of 100%. So, you know, we can't really get a good feeling for the absolute increase or decrease, because I'm sure that that's also increasing a lot when, you know, utilities are throwing out ridiculous capital plans like, yes, this mid-level utility is now going to be spending $60 billion in the next 5 years. And you're like, holy cow, like, it's a lot of money right now, and it's going to be in all these sectors. So what we try to do is we try to say, okay, where can we start cutting?
You know, everyone knew that you had to build more transmission and distribution to accommodate wind and solar, and that's the way we were going. And that was something we always talked about, because people would always point to the LCOEs of wind and solar and say, hey, look at how cheap these are. You know, well, those were missing the other aspect of the system costs that you need to put on your grid to accommodate them. And that's something that we always baked into our modeling. So you're seeing that rise, obviously. You know, that's just a result of going to more intermittent resources that you build further away from population load centers. But then you're also seeing the impacts of not having reliable capacity on the grid. So capacity markets in PJM, for example, are at their maximum. And that's because they actually have lower thermal firm capacity than they ever have, because they have been retiring coal plants and nuclear plants. And so you're seeing those prices rise. And it's not just PJM. You know, ERCOT doesn't have a capacity market, but they are essentially using their ancillary market as a makeshift capacity market to keep these plants alive. They've done other things to keep their natural gas plants on, but they're not building any new ones. So for the last 30 years in ERCOT, they have been building wind and solar, now batteries, to accommodate a massive load increase in ERCOT. And so I think you're just seeing that strain happen, where there's like these hidden costs that are trying to keep reliable firm capacity online. And for many years, we've been able to get away with it because we almost had a capacity excess for so long and demand wasn't growing. Well, now demand is growing and we no longer can just keep the status quo firm capacity online. We need to be building more. And to do that along with efforts to do the energy transition, I mean, you're just doubling, tripling costs on top of each other. So I think we're also seeing a lot of that.
Yeah, it's a really, really good way to really, you know, open up this conversation in a lot of directions. There's one direction I want to take it specifically, and I want to ask a question. But before I do, I want to caveat this with, this is by no means to discount the real human impacts of an affordability crisis on everyday people. You know, we started this conversation by talking about the fact that people need power to live their lives. It is something that we need to have, you know, robust, healthy lives, turn on our stove, turn on our lights, all of that. But I asked this question with that in mind. We mentioned before, you know, the sort of like LCOE, wind, solar, batteries look pretty good. We didn't maybe bake in some of those other costs that would be, you know, associated with the build out of something like wind, solar, batteries, other clean resources, other renewables. I'm curious if there is a reality in which we have to kind of just swallow the frog and build out new infrastructure that will be costly. You know, tell me a little bit more about your perspective on this idea that we do have aging infrastructure in the power system in the United States, regardless of what kind of power is going to, you know, pass through our lines, that when we turn on our lights, it doesn't really matter where it comes from. It's aging infrastructure regardless. Does that factor at all into the conversation about the increase in costs that get passed along to that end customer when we're thinking about building out new infrastructure that can suit more clean and renewable sources? You know, tell me a little bit about how those kind of factor into each other. This idea that infrastructure is aging no matter what because time passes, and the fact that we have new generation sources coming online that suggest a trend that is maybe not in the direction of coal. What are your thoughts there?
Yeah, of course, we were retiring a lot of aging infrastructure, and that's there. But I also think that we were retiring very capable power plants, especially nuclear plants. I feel like that's kind of the worst case example of this. But, you know, plenty of coal plants were retired, too. And if we just keep out of the conversation for now the premature retirements and focus simply on the aging power plants, you know, I think that you could very well just you could build another thermal power plant. You know, you can build another combined cycle. So I don't think it's necessarily the case that you have to go wind, solar, batteries. I think that nuclear is a better option than that even. And so if we're talking about investments, necessary investments, because that's right. You have to keep building infrastructure, especially when demand is rising. I just think that there's smarter ways to go about this. If you value the energy transition, if you value having cleaner energy sources, it kind of depends on what you assume is clean. Even our president would say that even coal plants are clean. You know, he loves that line. But you know, so I think it depends on what you think is clean. Lots of people are now including gas into that, but I think many people exclude nuclear in that. And I think that the way we're going about decarbonization is probably right now the worst way you could go about it. And so I think that a much better option would be to invest in valuable, reliable, baseload, dispatchable resources like gas and nuclear. Now, we've modeled plenty of grids, you know, whether it's natural gas, mostly natural gas, keeping coal plants alive, or if you want to decarbonize nuclear and wind, solar, and batteries. Wind, solar, and batteries, to get to those 90 to 100% decarb levels, it's always the most expensive way to go about this. And even with the high upfront capital costs of nuclear, it is more affordable than wind, solar, and batteries.
It's expensive.
Right.
Don't get us wrong.
Exactly.
It's expensive.
Right. It always costs money, in other words, to decarb. Thermal resources are more affordable, but they come with those emissions. And so if you prioritize getting rid of those, you have to think about what's the smartest way to go about it. And I think we're just doing it the worst way you could.
Yeah. And then there's also just like the transmission and distribution side of things, right? Like the distribution system is old, and yeah, maybe we should have been like investing in that during a period of low demand growth, but we didn't. We invested in charismatic megafauna of wind and solar. So now it's just like, okay, well, we had this like huge benefit of the shale revolution that took like natural gas prices dropped from $8 per million BTU to like two. Like, how cool is that? So we had this like fuel savings, and you know, it would have been really awesome if we had invested that into some of this hard infrastructure that is going to be needed, right? If you've got 50, 60 year old transmission and distribution stuff like we're seeing in California, that's a problem. That's a safety hazard. That is going to result in people having blackouts. So yes, unfortunately, there is going to be a take your medicine moment here. And the thing about it is like, well, let's figure out the smartest way to maximize the ratepayer dollar. And that's really what we're all about.
Yeah. Yeah. And, you know, there are spoonfuls of sugar, right? There are ways to take your medicine that are less painful than others.
Are there? I'd love to hear them, Kinsey.
Well, that's what I was just about to ask
in
you.
In the utility sector, boy, howdy. I don't know if there are.
What would be the best possible path forward? You know, and I think I asked this question, too, with it in mind that, you know, there perhaps it's looking even too far in advance for some of the utility folks. But the idea that we're talking about clean lost its meaning when, you know, coal was deemed clean, right? Like, I think that is maybe not the word that I want to use here, but renewable versus non-renewable is an interesting way to position this. We're looking at a potential non-renewable resource, not in our lifetime, probably not for a really long time. But, you know, how long are we kind of kicking the can down the road when we're looking at decarb goals that do matter, right? Like this is an important part of the conversation at the utilities and the people who work there who are listening to this show. Is there a way to figure out the best possible path from where we are today, which is prices are too damn high, to where we want to get, which is a reliable power system that runs on the right things, that keeps people and their well-being in mind? You know, how would you kind of chart that path if you had the magic wand to wave?
You know, we have a theory where people want decarbonized grids when prices are low and the economy is good. And as soon as that starts to go away, people want lower prices and they don't care where it comes from. And we're seeing this with the data center crowd because they were all about their clean energy commitments. And then you started to look at their, you know, annual reports, and all of a sudden you're like, oh, wow, Microsoft and Google's greenhouse gas emissions are steadily rising as they power their infrastructure. I'm waiting for them to announce a deal where they buy an old coal plant and keep it running and just take it behind the meter. Like, I think that day is coming because we are not in any sort of, like, it is crazy how much of a black and white distinction there was from, like, the election in November 2024. It was almost like the entire energy world flipped on its head because we went from talking about decarbonization as the, you know, primary focus of what we were doing as a country to, oh my God, data centers, like overnight. It was insane. Like, I've never seen like a paradigm shift change quite like that. We'll probably never see it again, honestly. Like, this is a big deal. You know, the problem is there are no spoonfuls of sugar when it comes to utility rate making to make the medicine go down. There just aren't. Like, when a company puts something in the rate base and it gets approved in the rate case, like, it's just like your prices never really go down, right? Like, that's just the way the math works. Unless you depreciate these assets over a really long time and then continue to utilize those depreciated assets, there's really no mathematical way for the price to go down, unfortunately. Unless your fuel price becomes free, or in case like Uncle Sam comes in and just decides we're going to subsidize your bill, right? Like, there aren't many levers that you can pull, which is why when President Trump was campaigning, he said he's going to cut your electric bill in half. People were reaching out to us like, hey, how can we do this? And I'm like, oh, I'm not touching this one because it's really difficult. It's really hard. So, you know, if you're going to continue to, you know, prematurely retire depreciated assets, I don't care if it's coal, gas, nuclear, then you're going to be making the pain worse. And the other thing is, like, how long does a wind turbine actually last? I'd love to know. And how long does the solar facility last? Because we're seeing an increase in repowerings after like 12 years. So, and that's purely a subsidy play. They just want to get the tax credits back, which, you know, does lower rates for their customers. So from a utility perspective, I understand why they're doing it. But, you know, maybe we should be building a system that's just actually least cost and isn't least cost asterisk with the subsidy or with the social cost of carbon or this externality or that externality, because like that leads you to a lot of really bad decisions. There's this fascinating utility docket, like this Longspur Wind is a proposed project by Minnesota Power. I want to write about it, haven't written about it yet. It's $4,000 a kilowatt, which is about, you know, three or four times more than wind was costing 5-6 years ago, right? So it's this massive, like, pig of a project when it comes to the cost. Like, you're looking at over $100 a megawatt hour for an onshore wind facility located in North Dakota. This is absurd. And they are justifying it by saying, oh, well, you know, once we calculate our $235 statutory social cost of carbon into our analysis, this is saving ratepayers millions of dollars over the like 35-year life of the turbine operating at a 50% capacity factor. It's all fiction. It's all like none of those assumptions are realistic, right? But they say it's going to save people money on paper. But then the best part of the whole filing is it's actually going to increase customers' bills by this much, but they're saving money because of the externality costs. So this is how the energy markets are so different. And that's why you see this like bifurcation of red states and blue states. If you tried to tell the North Dakota Public Service Commission that it was going to be lower cost to do this because of the social cost of carbon, they would laugh you out of the room. But in Minnesota, it's a very serious conversation with all the different stakeholders like the Sierra Club and Fresh Energy and all these other groups that are promoting this kind of stuff. So like all of these very serious people create all of these like impossible metrics to actually hit in terms of affordability. Like if you're going to be incorporating like an externality as your deal breaker for whether you allow a gas plant to go up, like you're just asking for higher prices. That's the end of the story. So maybe the spoonful of sugar is blue states can actually lower their prices because they are doing lots of stuff that are artificially increasing prices right now. And we're seeing like Rhode Island, I think, rolled back their compliance dates for their, you know, carbon-free mandates back to 2050. I think I saw that in the news. So you're seeing that happen in real time in the most expensive states, but it's a lot harder if you're already kind of doing the right thing to reduce your costs.
And yeah, and to Isaac's point, unfortunately, this is what happens when you have a massive misallocation of resources. We have been investing in resources that can't take on new load because you need capacity, you need firm capacity. And so when we have demand growth, all of a sudden, we're reinvesting in the sources that can handle that growth. And unfortunately for ratepayers, you're paying these off for 15, 20, 30 years. And you have to kind of wait for those to fall off the system before. And if you keep making these ill-advised decisions and keep going down the same route, well, what we've shown is that you have to keep repowering these plants, wind and solar and battery storage. There's never a time that they fully depreciate unless you want a really bad resource, like a wind resource, because they degrade over time. And what we saw in the leading into the early 2000s is prices were coming down, not just in an inflation adjusted value. They were coming down. And that's because A, demand was still growing at that time, but B, we were hitting the depreciation
sweet spot.
We had fully paid off power plants basically. And yeah, you have to keep investing to keep them going, but that initial capital expense is a huge portion of these costs. And so we were hitting paid off mortgages basically.
Yeah. It's like America had paid off its mortgage on its utility bills and they were supposed to be reaping those rewards. And then they actually got told, sorry, you're being evicted. We're building a net zero house and you need to pay it off all over again.
And it's just unfortunate. So with wind and solar, you hit this point where they come up here, the prices come up, and then they just kind of go like this because you have to keep repowering. For base load depreciable assets that last 60 years, but the depreciation is through 30, you do have to have this huge investment. But then they come down over time. And then, like Isaac said, we should be, dancing into the sun.
Enjoying our golden years.
Yeah, exactly.
Retirement? What's that? I don't think that exists
exactly.
Anymore.
We're not going to get Social Security.
Yeah. I'm not really familiar with the concept. No, but, no. This is, I think, it brings us to an interesting point in this conversation about policymaking and the role that this plays. A lot of that sudden shift was at the behest of lawmakers, of policy decisions that were made either at the state level, at the federal level. We're seeing that shift in real time over the last year and a half or so. I would love to get your thoughts on what feels like the sort of good faith policymaking versus the more symbolic policymaking or that kind of political cover style of policymaking that doesn't really materially improve affordability and maybe even reliability too. What kind of tend to be the markers of a policy that feels like it is designed with that ratepayer in mind versus a policy that maybe is not? Are there any patterns there that are identifiable?
I think that the trend of making data centers pay for their own stuff is like one of those good faith bipartisan deals. You saw the different governors go to PJM and say, hey, this capacity auction is not working for us. You guys have to figure something else out. I don't know how that works. You know, if you have a market clearing price that is not high enough to incent new generation, kind of like, to me, doesn't really make like markets economic sense. Like, how do you get that next incremental megawatt if the price isn't high enough? So, but you know, there is, I think that is a place where the conversation is like good faith. Also, you know, there are other states around the country where they're just saying, okay, you can take your data center behind the meter, some sort of consumer regulated electricity system. That passed in New Hampshire. I think that had bipartisan support. And there's also, you know, conversations in like Colorado and other states where they're saying, okay, well, the data centers have to pay for their own stuff. And I think that's a good thing. I think the data centers should have to pay. And, you know, ideally, you know, they would be increasing the denominator of sales so much that they're paying off the numerator of, you know, your total system costs for everyone else and potentially lowering those rates. The problem is, like Mitch said earlier, we've gotten rid of a lot of that extra slack in the rope when it comes to generators that are capable of powering, you know, almost like base load demand resources or ultra high load factor resources. I was listening to the S&P Global podcast like a month or so ago, and he said, if the data centers had come into PJM in 2018, we might not be having this conversation because there was still a lot of excess capacity on the system during that time. So I think that, you know, trying to get more gas on the system is going to be really important because as of right now, that's the only new thing that you can really build that's dispatchable in any sort of reasonable time frame. So to the extent that these conversations about permitting new pipelines is, you know, real and not just kind of political theater until the midterms are over, cool. Like, I'll take it. The let's keep our nuclear plants open has been like a fun development because shutting those down never made any sense. And, you know, I think at some point it's going to get to, all right, let's push back our carbon-free dates. And I think that those are also, those are real, but it's just interesting because those are only happening in the states that have ultra-aggressive carbon-free mandates. And those are almost uniformly, you know, states that lean left anyway. So like that's ultimately got to be like good faith, right? Because they're only negotiating with themselves.
The fact that we can't respond to taking on data centers, I think that points to a very bad thing in our markets, right? It's like there's something going on where historically where you want high load energy intensive industries to come online. And the fact that we can't respond to that, it not only suggests that the capacity markets aren't incentivizing, you know, enough capacity to meet there's also bad incentives that are incentivizing building energy sources that can't do it, right? So like mainly the subsidies, also the mandates, right? The subsidies are incentivizing people to build resources that are low value, unreliable. And maybe there is room for them as fuel savers in a perfect world where there is no subsidies. But I think that the subsidies are making the markets act like these are resources that can handle significant load and they can't. And now we're getting to a point where when you would ideally like these data centers to lower costs for everyone, well, they're not because we've just, like I said, we have such a misallocation of resources right now that the markets are all screwed up.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, it's a really important point to round out this conversation. And I think it leads us to this idea of, you know, let's say that these things happen, right? We get more gas, more permitting for new pipelines, keep more nuclear plants open, push back some of these decarb dates, have more advantageous or more thoughtful subsidies come to fruition. What does affordability look like in that world? Can you kind of project or make any predictions about what might happen to this affordability crisis should all of this come to pass, which I know is unlikely, but I'm curious about what this sort of ideal version of the future looks like to the two of you.
Well, that's why there's no sugar, Kinsey. Like, there is no sugar. It's just prices go up less than they otherwise would if we decided to invest less prudently. So that's it. The prices are going up. And that's the result of, you know, policy decisions that were made 10 years ago, whether that's, you know, regulatory regimes that, you know, incentivize certain generation over others, or, you know, the integrated. So the regulations influenced the IRPs, and the IRPs influenced the rate case, and the rate case today is what people are mad about. So problem is, there were a lot of like decisions for resource planning between the regulation and the IRP and the people being upset about it. So like, there's just this natural delay in the utility planning process that disadvantages normal people who are, you know, being told that their bills are going to go down because of energy efficiency and the fuel savings from wind and solar. So they've been fed a lot of inaccurate information because you're just increasing your fixed costs and you still have to have the dispatchable fleet, right? That's, you know, pretty straightforward stuff there. So the perfect affordability world is, you know, hopefully things don't get much more expensive than they are right now. Or maybe you just say, all right, data centers, you get to pay for everybody's power bill. But I don't think that that's going to pass like some sort of like just and reasonable metric. But maybe because it's big tech, no one will care. So like, I don't know. That's like the fantasy land way to reduce prices. I mean, eventually it will work potentially if you don't overinvest. If your numerator is prudently managed and you increase the denominator, maybe it'll work out for you, but I'm not holding my breath.
Yeah. Maybe the new call your senators is call your local big tech company building a data center.
You know, yeah.
It's really interesting to think about it this way. You know, both of you, I think, have certainly brought some really compelling stuff to the table in terms of the realities that we're all looking at. You know, the not so satisfying conclusion that it sounds like we're really coming to is the best possible outcome here is things just don't get crazy more expensive. They just get a little more expensive in a reasonable way over the long term. How do utilities talk to their customers about that? It's not really the most compelling story to tell. I'm curious if you have any ideas or feedback or suggestions for our utility listeners when they're talking about affordability with customers, when they're publicly speaking about the importance of affordability to the business that they're building, and then have to turn around and spend $60 billion in CapEx over the next 5 years. What does that story sound like? What should it sound like?
Well, that's interesting because I don't know if I would go to the utilities for this, right? I think we call what they've been doing green plating the grid. And so they're going to feed you all this stuff about affordability, but what they want is to rate base capital expenses so that they can have a higher rate of return. And of course, they can't do that, you know, just, you know, full blown because
they need a good pretense for doing
right,
so.
Right. Right. But, you know, in Minnesota, XL, for example, kept changing over time how they describe their low rates. You know, first it was going to stay below the national average, and then it was going to stay with the rate of inflation. And then they just stopped talking about it completely because they blew past all of those metrics over time.
They all do it. And like, all of them talk about their least cost portfolio, and their least cost portfolio was always just relative to some other portfolio that they modeled. It's BS baseline modeling that we've talked about, bait and switch, not, you know, the swear words, right? Because this is
you can
a
also say that
show. This is a family friendly show, Kinsey, at least for this episode. I'm dictating that at this moment. But no, so like, they don't show you the customer bill impact compared to today. They don't say, here's your bill today, and this is what you're going to pay under this IRP situation or that IRP situation. They say, that's too complicated. We can't do that. But ultimately, like, if I go out and I need to buy a new furnace, I look at, okay, this is what I paid for my last one, and here are the three or four models that I'm considering based on my house and my personal needs. But like, you don't get to do that as a consumer with the utility because it's a monopoly, and that's like fine, right? Maybe there is no free market for electricity, and maybe there never will be, and like, come to terms with that. But at the same time, like, they shouldn't get to just say, oh, well, yes, we're saving customers $100 million trillion by using, you know, portfolio A instead of portfolio B. And the only real difference is like, portfolio B was like $100 million trillion in $1. And then, you know, portfolio A is like a lot less. So
Well, and with that said, I think there's a lot of good people within the utilities that.
Oh, 100%. Yeah. Know, there are people that know that like yeah. what they've been doing is kind of
yeah.
fleecing and, their customers. Yeah.
And I think that's the problem here. The people who are speaking to ratepayers about this, they fundamentally can't be honest, because what are they going to say? Like, oh, we used your hopes and dreams to, you know, improve our profit margins, you know.
Gotcha.
And, like, yeah. So
just what just, every ratepayer wants problem. To hear.
Like, right.
You remember those really good intentions that you had about saving the planet? Right. We used it to enrich our investors.
Right.
Yeah. Like, okay, well, maybe they're not going to love hearing that.
You guys are getting me dangerously close to the episode that I want to make about breaking down how these business models work, the idea of a free market.
You got our email. You know how to find us.
We're going to have you back to do that one, because it's a whole other can of worms. But, you know, I think this is it's a good note to end on. I think often I like to try to kind of wrap things with a bow, a little optimism. This is just the reality. This is what we're all dealing with. I would love to encourage everybody listening to this to reach out to Isaac and to Mitch. If you disagree with anything that they said, hop into the comments. Let's get a dialogue going, because a lot of this, I'm sure will really resonate with, you know, people who are in and around utilities, who I'm sure have seen firsthand a lot of the conversation that we're talking about today. So I think we are now at the point to jump into, as if we haven't had enough hot takes in this episode, our lightning round, which is our quick rapid fire section. We are going to close this out with a couple questions here. If you could keep your answers to a couple words, maybe a sentence or two, that would be awesome. Are we ready to rock?
Yeah.
Okay. So first question for you: in these politically divisive times, I would love to hear if there's one thing you think everybody can get behind. What is a space for some common ground, maybe some bipartisan common ground? What's the one thing we can all agree on?
Nuclear.
Yep. Easy answer.
Easy layup. Okay. The next question for you here: what has you most excited about energy between now and, let's say, 2030, 2035? If you could give me a reason for optimism, that would be great, because it is really how I like to end these. So what are you looking forward to? What gives you a reason to be excited?
Well, it's absolute chaos. No one knows what's going to happen. So like, it's kind of fun.
And for me, the refocus on affordability. I like seeing that more.
Yeah. All right. I dig it. All right. And my final question for the both of you: can you give us some career advice? What is maybe some of the best career advice that you have gotten so far? What's your best tip for the listeners of today's episode?
Be as useful as you can. Take advantage of your strengths and make sure you're getting paid for it.
But also don't be afraid to pay your dues either, because sometimes you have to do that. You have to like do your internship and, because like I had to clean pig pens for a long time and I didn't get paid for that, but they also fed me. So like, it's kind of like, okay. But yeah, don't be a farmer maybe would be mine, but like, let's, you know, we can end on that.
That's fair. That's fair. And I like that you said, do your internship, and Mitch is nodding his head. It's real, yeah. Real great callback to the first question here about how the two of you started working together. So Mitch, Isaac, thank you both so much for joining me today on Power Perspectives. This has been obviously a wide ranging conversation. We touched on a ton here, and I am really grateful for all of the insight that you shared, all of the perspective that you brought to the table. So thank you so much for joining me today.
Thanks for having us.
Yeah, thanks for having us.
And thank you to all of you for listening. Once again, if you have any perspective, any 2 cents you want to share, feel free to chime in on this conversation. You can either head to the comments when we post this on YouTube, head to Energy Central's platform to share your perspective there, or feel free to email me anytime, kinsey@energycentral.com. And thank you again for listening. We'll see you next time here on Power Perspectives.